Good afternoon. We would like to welcome you to the Michigan State University Colloquy, Sexuality, A Search for Perspective. Today we have our 16th lecture in the series, and our general topic for this week is marriage and family. Tonight at 7 o'clock on the same topic, Dr. Clark Vincent will speak on marital and sexual health in modern society in the 108B of Wells Hall. And tomorrow at 4 o'clock, Ms. Satir will be back here in the auditorium speaking. Next week, the colloquy topic will be value considerations for moral and ethical decision making, and we will have as speakers Dr. Otis Maxfield, Dr. Lester Kirkendall, and Dr. Roy Menninger. So we'd like you all to attend next week's sessions as well as our other two meetings this week. Introducing our guest this afternoon is Dr. Herbert J. Oyer. Dr. Oyer received his bachelor's degree from Bluffton College, his master's in education from Bowling Green State University, and his PhD from Ohio State University. He was a high school teacher, has held assistant professorships at Bowling Green and Ohio State, and came to MSU as an associate professor in 1960. He since has moved from the directorship of speech and hearing clinics to professor of speech, then to chairman of speech, and is now professor and chairman of the Department of Audiology and Speech Sciences. I would also like to note that Dr. Oyer has found the time to publish over 50 articles and reports, besides writing two books with Dr. O'Neill of the University of Illinois and his own book, Applied Audiometry, in 1966. He has served as consultant to the United States government on numerous occasions, and as a part of this, he was involved in a trip to India to look for research possibilities there. He is a fellow of the American Speech and Hearing Association, and this year, he is a recipient of the MSU Distinguished Faculty Award. Dr. Oyer.
Thank you, Ms. Douglas. We're indeed fortunate this afternoon in having as our featured speaker a man whose education, whose training, and experience has great breadth and depth, a man who has devoted a great share of his professional and personal energies to the general area that he will discuss with us here this afternoon. Our speaker was born in Boston, Massachusetts, and spent his boyhood and adolescence in rural Mississippi. He's married and has one son and two daughters. His wife, Dr. Margaret Morgan Lawrence, is a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. Their three children are all presently working on advanced degrees in professional schools. His son is a senior in law at the Yale School of Law. One daughter is a doctoral student in sociology of education at Harvard University. A second daughter, who is married, is pursuing a master's degree at the Bank Street College of Education. Our speaker received the bachelor's degree from Morehouse College, the Master of Arts from Atlanta University with a major in sociology, and a doctoral philosophy degree from Columbia University in sociology. He has taught in the Atlanta public schools, has been instructor and research associate at Fisk University. He's been field executive of the National Student YMCA, and since 1948 has been at Brooklyn College at the City University of New York. He now holds the rank of professor and chairman of the Department of Sociology. His major teaching and research interests are in race relations and the family. He has authored numerous articles which have appeared in Social Problems, Christianity in Crisis, and the American Sociological Review. Our speaker, in addition to all of this, is active in the Episcopal Church and also in civic affairs. He is a vice chairman and former national chairman of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a fellow of the American Sociological Association, and a fellow for the Society for Religion in Higher Education. It gives me great pleasure to present to you this afternoon Dr. Charles R. Lawrence, whose address is entitled Color, Class, and Culture, A Minority View. Dr. Lawrence.
Thank you, Mr. Oyer and Ms. Douglas. I was impressed a few minutes ago that the canned music, the piped music, I should say, seemed to indicate that my reputation as a lecturer from New York had preceded me as I heard the strains of A Lullaby of Broadway. I was reminded of the professor who dreamt that he was lecturing and woke up and discovered that he was. Family life among Negro Americans is particularly and peculiarly a product of the American experience. Chattel slavery, as practiced in the Anglo-American colonies and later in the United States, involved a systematic extirpation of the African cultural past. It is true that significant vestiges of African cultural traits are to be found in some of the more isolated, large-scale plantation areas, such as the Sea Islands of South Carolina. But by and large, the African past was extirpated by slavery. The patriarchal, frequently polygynous families of Black Africa were part of a complex cultural system and could hardly have survived through America's peculiar institution. Wanted to try this anyway. Even if the slavocrats had been willing to tolerate it, and this was by no means the case. Anglo-Saxon Protestants also found it necessary to justify their enslavement of Black Africans, to reconcile it with their religious beliefs. For a while, it was enough to rationalize the slave trade as a large-scale effort at Christian proselytism. The Black heathen was to be saved, whether he liked it or not, and in spite of himself. There was even an early belief that a Christian had an obligation to free a slave who professed Christianity. This errant doctrine did not, however, survive beyond the seventh decade of the 17th century. In its stead, a kind of biblical racism arose based upon the story of Ham, which the more biblically literate of you will know. You remember Ham was disrespectful to his drunken father and as a result was sentenced, and all of his descendants were sentenced to be hewers of wood and drawers of water for their brethren. And by the time of the African slave trade, particularly those pinkish white brethren whom we call pinkish gray brethren whom we call white. Ethnocentrism was, of course, nothing new in the world. But the notion of the innate inferiority of dark-skinned people had its origin in the African slave trade. Biblical racism has long since been supplemented and even supplanted by pseudo-scientific racism, but it still persists today among some of the more backward segments of our population. The Anglo-Saxon rationalization of slavery placed the Black African in a subhuman, or at least an absolutely inferior category. Judge Taney's obiter dictum in the Dred Scott decision, you remember, took off from his notion that in the preamble to the Constitution, the phrase, the people of the United States, did not include Negroes. And the, in a sense, the racism that developed to justify slavery, Black African slavery, anticipated the Taney doctrine. And this had two results, among others. Slaves were equated with things on the same level as other domestic animals, except insofar as it suited the slavocrats to count them as two-thirds of a person to give additional congressional representation to the slave owners. The second result was to set up a standard by which the least Caucasians were inherently superior to the best and wisest Negroes. Color racism, popularized as a rationalization for the African slave trade, thus became inextricably interwoven with the history of Black families in the United States. It is instructive to take a cursory look at the development of family styles among Negroes during the slave era. E. Franklin Frazier pointed to the close relationship between the exigencies of the plantation economy on the one hand and the kinds of family life evolved during slavery on the other. As slavery became institutionalized, a division of labor and of social status emerged among the slaves. This division of labor was pronounced on the large plantations, and these tended to set the tone for the more numerous, smaller slaveholding units, where most of the slaves were also found. The brief account that follows is necessarily ideal typical in the sociological sense, and does not take into account many exceptions to the general pattern. At the very bottom of the slave system were the field hands, who were also the largest group of slaves. It was they who did the sun-to-sun labor in the fields, torn from their African heritage on the one hand and isolated from their white masters on the other. This group developed a matricentric family system. Males in this group, particularly the young males, constituted a large part of the master's liquid assets and were most vulnerable to being sold off of the plantation when ready cash was needed. Of the entire slave population, field hand males were also the most likely to run away, for their toil was not even requited by the psychic income of approbation for a job well done, and it was they who most often felt the driver's lash. Both the opportunity and responsibility of claiming their progeny as their own and being responsible for them was denied, although the begetting of such progeny was actively encouraged. The women of this group worked alongside their men in the fields or at other low-status work. Parturition provided only a brief respite from toil, and the mother of a newborn baby was expected to return soon to her tasks in the field, leaving her child to the care of her own mother or even her own grandmother. The field hand household became, in Frazier's words, the house of the mothers, and the role of the grandmother became the most important source of nurture and continuity, a still common phenomenon among lower status Negro families. It is important to keep in mind that the field hand slave families were not matriarchal, because that would mean the mothers ruled. They were rather a peculiar sort of patriarchy in which the master ruled and the mothers provided the nurture for the family. For the mother, or more likely the grandmother, provided such stability as the family unit knew, along with an amazing amount of nurture and affection. There were, of course, many stable, monogamous relationships among field hands, and on many of the small to medium-sized plantations, master families tried to encourage all of their slaves to adopt European marriage customs, occasionally providing the sanction of the church, though not the state, for such alliances. The economics of the slave plantation, however, militated against such practices, and the matrifocal family was probably the norm for field hands. Two other groups of slaves are identifiable in terms of the plantation's division of labor: the house servants and artisans. Within the plantation social hierarchy, these two groups had about equal standing. The house servants consisted of those persons employed within the immediate household of the master. They were chosen in part because of their attractiveness and tractability. As coachmen, cooks, maids, nursemaids, butlers, etc., they were in intimate contact with the master class. Their material lot was moreover considerably superior to that of their brethren in the fields, for they often ate the same food as the masters rather than the slave victuals provided in the quarters. Instead of the coarse homespun garments provided for field hands, house servants arrayed themselves in the cast-off finery of the big house. You may recall that Denmark Vesey, the insurrectionist leader in South Carolina, advised his lieutenants not to enlist in his conspiracy, quote, such as wear old clothes from the master, end quote. For he recognized that the house niggers, as they were called, usually developed a strong identification with their oppressors. Among the artisans to be found on a large plantation were carpenters, masons, cobblers, blacksmiths, iron workers, and others whose training represented a very heavy economic investment. Like the house servants, they worked relatively close to their masters, and they also gained considerable influence. House servants and artisans therefore tended to assimilate European values regarding families and monogamous concubinage marriages, for the double standard of sexual morality was nowhere more honored in observance than in the antebellum South. The males in this group wished to emulate their master's family style, and their intimacy and influence with the master often enabled them to maintain stable relationships with less fear that they or their mates would be sold away. A quasi-patriarchal family life therefore developed within this group. Outside the slave system, but greatly influenced thereby, were the free Negroes. By 1860, these numbered 488,000 souls, or 11% of the total American Negro population. As Frazier points out, quote, contrary to popular belief, the free class may even be said to be prior in origin to the slave class, since the first Negroes brought to America did not have the status of slaves, but of indentured servants. Court records show that Negroes were released originally upon the completion of a term of servitude, end of quotation. Aside from those slaves, those persons whose families' ancestors had never been slaves, the free Negro population was increased from time to time by mulatto children born of free colored mothers, mulatto children born of white servants or free women, children of free Negro and Indian parentage, manumitted slaves, that is, slaves freed at the hands of their masters. Many also were the result of having taken French leave of that peculiar institution. Large numbers of free Negroes resided in such cities as New York, Boston, and Philadelphia in the north, and Charleston, Baltimore, Washington, and New Orleans, Augusta, Georgia in the south. There were also many rural settlements of free Negroes, particularly in Virginia and North Carolina, and notably in the Ramapo foothills of New Jersey and New York, and in Cassopolis, Michigan, and Wilberforce, Ohio. These families provided leadership by establishing Negro churches, newspapers, lodges, free schools, Sunday schools, and other agencies of self-help and mutual aid, North and South. It was from this group that leadership for the anti-slavery movement and the Negro convention movements came. As a matter of fact, some of our black militants' present-day prose pales when compared with the writings of David Walker or Frederick Douglass, and the latter seem to make themselves effective without even the resort to profanity or obscenity. Although most of these families lived economically precarious lives, many were skilled workers, caterers, and subsistence farmers. The family organization was usually strongly patriarchal, although female-headed families were quite common, particularly in southern cities. The hierarchy of statuses upon the plantation, together with free people of color, provided for the evolution of an intra-racial system of color, an intra-racial system of stratification long before the Civil War. Through historical circumstances, this system of stratification, an incipient class system, if you will, was highly correlated with pigmentation. Field hands were predominantly of relatively unmixed African ancestry. The intimate contacts between house servants and the masters, of which I spoke earlier, were both the results of and the occasion for considerable sexual relations between white males and black females, and their progeny tended to have preferred positions within the plantation system. A very high proportion of the free Negro population was made up of mulattoes. Indeed, they formed a distinct, recognized caste in antebellum New Orleans, for example. There was, therefore, concrete evidence not only that white was superior, but that in general the blacker one was, the further down in the social hierarchy was he to be found. Through historical circumstances and the workings of the self-fulfilling prophecy phenomenon, the color racism, which had served as a justification for slavery, was given a spurious, though all too convincing confirmation in the intra-group stratification that developed within the slave and free Negro population. The dominant racist values were indeed widely accepted within the subordinate group, an acceptance summed up in the Negro folk saying, if you white, you all right. If you brown, stick around. If you black, get back. Now, this acceptance of the dominant color values has also been repeatedly confirmed by studies of color preference among Negroes and is in evidence in the numerous ads for hair straighteners and skin bleachers in black papers and magazines, even some which have a very militant editorial policy. The structures and functions of black families during slavery were formed by the relationships of family members to the processes of production. Social roles were highly correlated with economic roles. A system of intra-racial stratification based upon social and economic role and highly correlated with skin color was developed. Although legalized slavery ended a little more than a century ago, economic circumstances continue to be crucial in the family life of American Negroes. The closer one is to the margin of economic subsistence, the more his family life is affected by economic circumstances. For most of the period since emancipation, Negroes were rural folk. On the plantations of the Deep South, they struggled to climb the agricultural ladder from sharecropper to share tenant, eventually to owner. For those at the lowest rung of the ladder, the family remained still essentially matricentric. For a woman, as easily as a man, could enter into the sharecropper contract, promising her labor and that of her children in return for a share of the cash crop. She could, moreover, take up with a man who could help her farm and add to her progeny. And as Charles S. Johnson pointed out in Shadow of the Plantation, this was acceptable to her neighbors as long as she acted responsibly toward her children. Those families who rose to the status of cash tenants, who simply rented the land and supplied their own work animals and tools, were most often headed by men, as were the families of owner-operators. The social standing of the family was derived, that is, of owner-operator and renter families, the social standing of the family was derived from the father's economic position and from his participation in church, mutual aid societies, and other community activities. The most important and striking change in black families during the past half century has been their increasingly rapid rate of urbanization. In 1910, the Negro population of America was 73% rural. By 1960, it was 73% urban. And 69% of the Negro population now lives in metropolitan areas, that is, in or around the largest cities. This process of urbanization has had many concomitants, and I will just mention a few. It has resulted in increased social stratification resulting from greater economic and occupational differentiation. It has resulted in the growth of associations, the development of parallel institutions and social movements. It has also resulted in increased residential segregation and also in new problems which arise with urbanization. Situations which were not defined as problems on the plantation. Urbanization has also seen the emergence of an authentic middle class with all of the attributes of the great American middle class, its virtues and its vices. And finally, It has resulted in increased group consciousness, particularly manifest recently in the emphasis upon black consciousness and negritude. It is within the context of the foregoing concomitants of urbanization that I should like to examine contemporary family life among American Negroes, indicating something of its variety, as well as suggesting the continuing importance of color and class. Based upon an extrapolation of the 1960 census figures and interdecennial estimates, there are upwards of 24 million Americans of some recognizable and recognized African descent, between 11% and 12% of the total population of the United States. The non-white population is growing, moreover, at nearly twice the rate of the white population, the former having increased 14.4% between 1960 and 1965, while the white population increased 7.4% during the same period. Negroes have for a long time known large cities as places of relatively greater freedom and opportunity. They've been attracted to cities by the prospect of better jobs, better educational opportunity, and lessened proscriptions. And these attractions were at work during the various waves of cityward migration from the boll weevil migration of 1900-1910 through the migrations of the First and Second World Wars and the periods in between those wars and since those wars. These aspirations and hopes have resembled those of various Europeans who came as immigrants, some of those literally expecting to find the streets of New York paved with gold. There's also been, in the terms of the demographers, an enormous push complementing the pull. The rationalization of Southern agriculture, that is, automation and making Southern agriculture more economically feasible, was first facilitated by the agricultural policies of the New Deal, policies which greatly favored the large-scale farmer and enabled him to take advantage of revolutionary developments in agricultural technology and chemistry. And your own great university has contributed greatly to this agricultural revolution through chemical and other discoveries. Before their rationalization, plantations in the Deep South, for example, required large complements of labor, labor that was essentially seasonal, but which remained in residence on the plantations as sharecroppers or in nearby towns, available for such peak labor periods as cotton chopping and cotton picking. Inasmuch as a docile labor force was preferred, and since the work demanded no book learning, education of farmhands was neglected, if not actively discouraged. Their ignorance helped them to, quote, know their place, end quote. Nowadays, only a fraction of the previous labor force is needed, and the operation of complex farm machinery and modern farming methods demands at least functional literacy on the part of workers. Those who are least suited, therefore, to contemporary farming life are precisely those workers who lack the literacy and work discipline needed in the urban labor force. The most likely candidates for separation from agriculture in the Deep South are, and have recently been therefore, those least prepared for city life, even under the best of circumstances, and their circumstances have been the worst. Many of the problems of our central cities are directly attributable to the dislocations of Southern agriculture. It is ironic, therefore, that Southern congressmen took the lead in the unholy alliance that last year voted the federal government would not finance any increase in the proportion of aid to dependent children and families already to that which their proportion already bore to the population of the state. Then, of course, the constituencies of these same congressmen proceeded to starve out those people who would then contribute to the rolls up north, so that the proportion available to the south would increase and the proportion available to the north would decrease. It is my belief that a careful analysis would show that much of the apparent deterioration that Moynihan and others see among black urban families is a reflection of the fact that pathology which was ignored among rural folk are not viewed as social problems on the plantation, is made manifest in the cities, even to the second or third generation of persons unassimilated into urban life. Relative deprivation would seem to me much more important than absolute deprivation in considering the American scene. American families, for example, with poverty incomes would be considered rich in other parts of the world. But the fact is that they don't live in other parts of the world. They live here, where they see other people living in much greater comfort. 40% of America's black families had incomes of less than $3,000 per year in 1964. Fewer than 20% of white families were to be found in that category. Although we must recall that that meant twice as many whites as Negroes were poor. And a much larger proportion of the whites were among the aged and the rural. In other words, the poverty among Negro families affects many more children proportionately than the poverty among white families. About half of the Negro and white urban families had incomes of between $3,000 and $7,000, $7,500 in 1961. But most of the remaining whites had higher income, and most of the remaining Negroes had lower income. As Sinclair Drake points out, quote, getting an education pays off for Negroes as for all other Americans. But while some Negroes get ahead of other Negroes, education has not yet raised their earning power to the level of whites with equivalent training. In fact, the average income for a non-white family with a male head who had finished high school was less than that of a white male head who had finished only the eighth grade, end of quote. As a matter of fact, a Negro male has to finish college before he gets the equivalent lifetime earnings of a white male who finishes high school. And I don't think this can be completely explained in terms of the differences in the quality of education. The median income of urban Negro families has been improving relative to that of whites during the last 10 years, though it lost relative to whites during the 50s. As of 1966, slightly more than half of America's white families had incomes of $7,000 a year or more, while 23% of non-white families were to be found in this category. Black families have been moving up relatively faster than white families, for while the proportion of whites receiving $7,000 or better the proportion of whites receiving $7,000 or better had increased by two-thirds, the proportion of black families at this level had increased by 2.5 times. Two warnings are necessary, however, before we sing our hosannas too highly and too loudly. Those black families who had crossed the 7,000 or greater barrier tend to be concentrated near the bottom of this open-ended category, while white families were concentrated several thousand dollars higher. Earlier on, it was noted that color and class continue to be the most important parameters for the consideration of family life among Negro Americans. I turn now, and it's about time, to a consideration of intra-group stratification. I should like to identify the various strata, suggest some of the indices for membership in each, say something of the family lifestyles characteristic of each category, and in some instances, indicate something about differential life chances. The uppermost stratum of America's black population is roughly comparable to the general American upper middle class. It includes old line professionals, successful entrepreneurs, blacks who have moved into middle management, research, public relations, and marketing as executives in America's business world, educated and established clergy, and celebrities. Such families are likely to reside in the more fashionable sections of the black ghetto, in the relatively gilded suburban and semi-suburban ghettos, and in significantly increasing numbers in upper middle class, predominantly white neighborhoods, used frequently suburban. Wives typically are employed, except when their children are quite young, and their occupations resemble those of their husbands. Marriages tend to be relatively egalitarian at this level, as is the case with upper middle class in general. Mothers in this group lead an active club life, many in addition to full-time employment. A highly visible segment of this stratum, in the Northeast, for example, spends summer vacations at Martha's Vineyard, Wildwood, New Jersey, Sag Harbor on Long Island, other fashionable watering places, and they have European travel and they go to the Caribbean in the wintertime. The conspicuous consumption and foibles of the Nouveau Riche blacks have been chronicled in E. Franklin Frazier's famous polemic, Black Bourgeoisie. It should also be noted, however, that this group provides a principal source and has provided a principal source of leadership for the civil rights movement, for such organizations as the NAACP, the National Urban League, and the National Congress of Negro Women. Small families are the rule within this group, and in the larger middle class group of which this is a part. And there is a disproportionately large number of childless couples. This is due in part to the high incidence of working mothers. It also reflects a desire to limit offspring in order to be able to, quote, do well, end quote, by them. Child rearing is greatly influenced by current popular doctrines. And there's a nationwide network of clubs for children and adolescents maintained in order that the progeny from this stratum may learn proper social graces, associate with the right people, and hence find an appropriate mate. This has gotten to be embarrassing to some of our young men and women as they have become more black and more militant. A young nephew of mine was attending a small Midwestern college. One of the other three or four Negroes on the campus was an angry black militant from the central city of Philadelphia. And he was very black and very militant and very, very angry in every issue of the school newspaper. And one day when my nephew and this young man met, my nephew said, "Oh, I know you. We were in the," he said, "Nigger, if you say it, I'll kill you." My nephew was about to say that they were both members of the Jack and Jill Club, you see, which would point him out, which would immediately dub him as part of the black bourgeoisie, and he couldn't afford to be that and also be the sort of militant he was pretending to be in that college. Color is relevant to this group in several ways. The uppermost stratum among Negroes had its origin among the free families and domestics of the pre-Civil War years, and these were predominantly mulatto. As achievement has replaced family of orientation, of origin, or rather joined it as a passport into this group, the importance of skin color has declined. More than vestiges of intra-group color prejudices remain, however, in spite of the growth of black consciousness. The external color bar persists for the Negro upper stratum. Social standing and income may shield them from many of the cruder forms of racial discrimination, although few members of this group have been spared less gentle reminders of the caste-like nature of America's black-white relations. Let me cite two instances from New York City, where, as our municipal radio station reminds us every noon, 8 million people live together in harmony and enjoy the blessings of liberty and democracy. One, a beautiful, well-dressed woman in her early 20s boarded an elevator on leaving the home of friends in a luxury apartment house on the east side. The elevator operator sought to force her to take the service car. When she pointed out that she was a guest, he proceeded all the way down the 16 stories to make nasty remarks about how careful one has to be in these days of high crime rates. The young woman found his boorishness hard to take, but the consenting silence of the half dozen tenants on the car brought tears of rage when she was safely out of sight. The second instance is a young colleague who recently joined us. His grandfather was an internationally known university president, and the young man was in the final stages of writing a doctoral dissertation. He and his wife spent 3 months of daily searching before they found a suitable apartment for themselves and their young daughter. Time after time, they were told that an apartment had been rented just the night before, when 10 minutes before, by telephone, they had been told that it was available. Agents, landlords, even building superintendents were uniformly courteous, but their intent was unmistakable. Another point of contact with the external color bar for upper status Negroes is in being plenipotentiaries, ambassadors to their Caucasian brethren. They're expected to supply the one or two black board members for a charitable enterprise, or the voice of color on a committee. And it has long since been their happy obligation to integrate soirees and cocktail parties. In this latter obligation, however, they are rapidly being replaced by angry young black militants from the ghetto, now that confrontation is the name of the game. Of course, one need be neither young nor black nor from the ghetto to be a young black militant from the ghetto. This role can be taken on, as it is quite frequently now, by persons who by no means fit it otherwise. Now, by no means all of the mainstream participation by upper status blacks is mere tokenism. An ever increasing, though still all too tiny, number have regular, normal, and easy social interaction with whites of equal status at work, in voluntary associations, as well as in more intimate social contacts. For this small fraction of an already tiny group, friends and associates are likely to be chosen on the basis of common interests, regardless of race. Just below this upper stratum, and hardly distinguishable from it, are those black families, and part of it, really, are those black families of middle-class standing. Parents in these families typically have finished high school, and in recent years, most have attended college. Incomes range from $7,000 to $15,000 per year. Andrew Billingsley notes that the line between the group I identify as upper middle class Negroes and this group is a rather fluid one, and that for all purposes, we may think of them as the same. Their lifestyles are exceedingly similar one to another, and their patterns of child rearing, men-women relationships are very similar, though the more general middle class tends to be somewhat more quasi-patriarchal than does the upper middle class. Probably the largest single group of Negro families are to be found in the working class, people who have a relatively regular employment at jobs that provide adequate income for subsistence and even some of life's luxuries. This is the group which Drake calls the Negro middle class. I think it less confusing, however, to use categories of the general American middle class, seeing class as embodying relationship to the means of production, as Marx said, as well as lifestyle and status. Indeed, Drake includes part of what I have called the middle class, as well as the working class, in the following summary statement. The Negro middle class covers a very wide income range, and whatever cohesion it has comes from the network of churches and social clubs to which many of its members devote a great deal of time and money. What sociologists call the Negro middle class is merely a collection of people who have similar lifestyles and aspirations, whose basic goals are, quote, living well, being respectable, and not being crude, end quote. Middle-class Negroes, by and large, are not concerned about mobility into the Negro upper middle class, or integration with whites. They want their rights and good jobs, as well as enough money to get those goods and services which make life comfortable, end of the Drake statement. The penchant of this segment of the black population for being respectable and not being crude is reflected in their lifestyle. The importance of education is held very high, and much of the support for educational reform in black neighborhoods has come from working class parents, particularly working class mothers. The threat of being overcome by pathological influences of the ghetto is ever present with this group. Yet most of these families hold together. Their apartments are often islands of cleanliness and neatness in the midst of filth and even structural deterioration. The extended family continues to function within this group despite the ravages of urbanization. And along with the black middle class, the working class provides the manpower through which churches, lodges, and other institutions in Negro neighborhoods are maintained. Working class blacks have always been more attracted to black nationalism than have their more highly situated brethren. It was among the respectable black masses, including many of West Indian origin, that Marcus Garvey found members for his Universal Negro Improvement Association and for the Back to Africa movement. They were, of course, an equally fruitful source of recruits for Martin Luther King Jr. and the nonviolent movement for human rights and integration. It is doubtful, however, that the appeal of integration was ever as strong within this group as the desire for a larger measure of freedom and personal dignity. Now, despite much current conventional wisdom, I am not suggesting any inconsistency between integration on the one hand and dignity on the other. Quite the contrary, they seem to me to be inseparable in our society. But there's no time to go into that at this time. Reference was made earlier to the importance of the extended family within the working class. It is also important within the respectable underclass, insofar as the extended family can be sustained in the underclass. It is through the extended family that matricentrality is maintained within working class black families. Working parents living in northern cities often send their children south, the latter's grandmother, most often maternal grandmother, to be cared for during preschool and early school years. Grandma thus continues to be the central adult figure for the growing child, even though the nuclear family may be quasi-patriarchal. Lower class families constitute To move now to the lower class. Lower class families constitute about 40% of America's black families and more than half of her black children. This segment of the black population includes the underemployed, the chronically employed, persons dependent upon public assistance, those who have simply dropped out of the labor market, minor hustlers, etc. They have recently received much attention from scholars and journalists alike. The Moynihan Report, though titled The Negro Family, dealt almost exclusively with this group. The overwhelming bulk of sociological research and punditry on black families deals with the black underclass. In part, this preoccupation reflects the urgency of gaining empirical data on which to base intelligent action. Two other reasons for our preoccupation with lower class black families must be mentioned. As recipients of relief, tenants in public housing projects, and idlers in the marketplace, they are available to us and unable to protect themselves from our prying eyes and tape recorders. Secondly, their behavior, particularly their sexual behavior, has been perceived as exotic from our middle class point of view, and therefore titillation spurs scientific inquiry. It is in the latter connection that an undue interest has been placed upon the most pathological minority within the Negro middle lower class. Commenting on the tendency of scholars to focus upon the black underclass and upon the most pathological within it, Andrew Billingsley has said, quote, "For it must be said with all candor that the social scientists who have recently discovered the Negro family have not yet produced a study of the 75% of Negro families who have stable marriages, or that half of all Negro families who have managed to pull themselves into the middle class, or that 90% of all Negro families who are self-supporting, or even that larger portion who managed to keep out of trouble often despite the most gross kinds of discrimination and provocation. It would be very instructive indeed to know how two-thirds of Negro families with less than $2,000 annual income, that is of those families that have $2,000 or less in annual income in 1966, could manage to hold themselves together and meet the American test of family stability. End of quote. It is partially in response to this overemphasis upon family life among lower class blacks that I have given a disproportionate attention to other groups in this paper. Not even families of the black underclass should be seen as an undifferentiated mass. A widely recognized distinction is that between Drake and Caton call the respectables and the shadies. The lives of the respectable underclass revolve around their churches, frequently the storefront variety with a high incidence of Pentecostals, Holy Rollers, the Church of God and Saints of Christ, as well as Baptists and Methodists. Religion is primarily understandable at this level as an opiate and a relief from frustration. These churches also provide a sense of belonging and solidarity with fellow worshipers, as well as some sense of self-worth in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Lower class respectables are unlikely to have any associational life aside from that related to their churches. The shadies find themselves involved in petty hustles, such as prostitution, narcotics, petty thievery, and numbers running. Some of the less decorous bars provide the release which their more respectable fellows find in storefront churches. Much of the lives of the parents of black underclass families are spent in an unremitting and unrelenting struggle for existence. Most of the parents, whether they are mother and father, or father alone, or mother alone, work at full-time jobs, but jobs which are not very remunerative. In our more enlightened jurisdictions, such families are eligible for supplemental public assistance. The leader of a municipal employees union in New York recently demanded that employees of the City Housing Authority be paid wages commensurate with their family size, pointing out that many full-time city employees were eligible for and receiving relief payments. Many other otherwise praiseworthy institutions, such as hospitals, restaurants, and even universities, maintain vital services through involuntary subsidies supplied by the poor. That is, poor people who work full-time, receive pittances as wages, are helping to educate any number of us in very plush universities. Moynihan, among others, has emphasized the breakdown of the black underclass family, and he has pointed to the rapid increase, or what he called the rapid increase in the proportion of such families headed by women. Elizabeth Herzog, on the other hand, has noted that in the very period about which Moynihan was most disturbed, there was no appreciable increase in the percentage of Negro families with female heads. As you will recall, Moynihan also cites the fact that there had earlier been a positive correlation between additions of Negroes to the roles of aid to dependent children, on the one hand, and rise in unemployment rates among Negro males on the other. In recent years, however, he observed, an apparent drop in Negro unemployment had not been accompanied by a rise in relief roles. And in other words, despite the fact that more Negro males were working, the relief roles rose. And this was a major element in his argument that the black family was deteriorating. Now, it seems to me that two additional important variables must be considered in this analysis. One is the continued movement of dependent and partially dependent families out of areas in which they couldn't get on relief, despite their need, into areas in which they can. So the roles rise, not because their need rises, but because people find themselves where the need is attended to rather than where the need was ignored. And secondly, the growing conviction among such families that public assistance is a right, a view encouraged by the growing welfare rights movement. It is another instance in which the perceived urgency of a social problem is due to its discovery rather than to its existence. Though a father is present more often than absent in black underclass families, the pattern is clearly matrifocal. The stability and continuity of the nuclear family is mainly dependent upon the mother, or in many cases, the grandmother. Rates of illegitimacy are high within this group. An exceedingly high fertility rate within this group, particularly coupled with a high rate of illegitimacy, is not to be taken lightly, and I'm not taking this situation lightly. For as Hyland Lewis has pointed out, although illegitimacy may carry relatively little stigma among one's lower class peers, the penalties to children born in penalties are still very great in terms of their eventual life chances. Therefore, we cannot ignore illegitimacy simply on the grounds that people among whom the mothers of illegitimate children live don't stone them or treat them the way respectable people think they ought to be treated. I think it also ought to be noted at this point that, again in connection with my colleague Hyland Lewis when he was in Washington, a very large-scale study, an intensive study, was done of lower-class, lower-income white and black families. An important finding of that was that many of these maternal families were doing an exceedingly good job of child-rearing. One of the facts that Lewis was reminded of was it's better to have a good marriage than no marriage, but probably better, and this is the philosophy found frequently among mothers of illegitimate children as they explain why they don't marry the fathers. They'd rather have no marriage than a bad marriage. This makes a good deal of sense, it seems to me. But also, what Lewis found was that many of these poor females with their families were doing an excellent job of child rearing, very often a better job than many of their more affluent neighbors. Much has been made of such characteristics as serial monogamy, proneness to violence, and poor motivation toward education and vocational achievement among the American black underclass and among the underclass in general. Walter Miller and others have attributed these characteristics to cultural differences. Not only is lower class behavior different from that of middle class people, according to this view, their aspirations are also different. Oscar Lewis has also written a great deal about the poverty culture, or culture of poverty. The notion of poverty culture has become a byword and a hissing, as school people and social workers have taken up the cry of, quote, cultural deprivation, quote, the culturally different, the culturally deprived, often transliterated into the culturally depraved. One result has been that those who have responsibility for education, social services, and job training in poor neighborhoods have used the notion of a culture of poverty as an exotic excuse for their own miserable results. The culture of the poor has also become a euphemism for the behavior of blacks, a view that has given some probably unintended credence to the current cult of negritude so popular since Fanon. Careful studies of black and white poor by Hyland Lewis and Helen Safer, Lee Rainwater, among others, have demonstrated that such so-called middle-class values as family stability and a desire for an education are shared by the poor in the sense that they know them to be, quote, right, end quote, and think that they would rather live by them. Their objective economic and social circumstances simply do not permit them to do so. They learn to live with themselves and to tolerate their neighbor's inability to, quote, live right, end quote, but they do not abandon nor repudiate the larger societal standards which we, with understandable statocentricity, call middle class, thus arrogating their putative virtues to ourselves. Explaining the behavior of the poor in terms of class differences is inadvertently analogous to the tendency of an earlier age to explain poverty in terms of biological differences. It is in a not very subtle way, it exonerates us for all blame for their predicament. It is my contention that the deviant lifestyles of the poor, insofar as they are pathological, are to be explained much more in terms of the structure of our society, the fact that the poor are de facto excluded from our opportunity system. I have sought to describe something of the origins and operations of social stratification among and against black families, the significance of color and class in their lives. I've also attempted to suggest, with all too inadequate discussion of it, the paucity of the poverty of culture concept in dealing with the problems of the black underclass, and by implication, black families in general. Without attempting to discuss them, I should now like to raise some questions that seem apposite in considering the future of black families in America. What of men-women relations among black families? In general, lower class and working class families have tended to be matricentric. Middle class families have been quasi-patriarchal, and upper middle class families have been egalitarians, with some real patriarchs among the older, so-called old families. At the same time, Negro women have had a long time educational and vocational advantage over Negro men, except at the very highest status levels. The historical powerlessness of the black male vis-a-vis the dominant society has also been a source of weakness and rage. It is often said that the black male has been castrated, a figure of speech that flies in the face of his fecundity. An important element in the contemporary black mood is the elevation of the black male to a position of dominance, even if this means that the black female must feign weakness. A recent letter, for example, in the New York African American Teachers Newsletter, written by a black woman teacher, urges her sisters to step back, let men take the lead, even if women, thanks to the machinations of the white overlords, have had more leadership and experience and are more capable. I mean, this is her idea, that even if we are more capable, we shouldn't try to lead, we must make the men lead. The Black Power Conference in Newark, under the strong influence of the Muslims, denounced birth control among blacks as genocide. Now that the middle class Negroes do not share this view is evidenced by the fact that they have even fewer children than whites of comparable education and income. And this is true of the middle class Negroes who were signed the resolutions at the Black Power Conference as well. Planned Parenthood clinics have been attacked, sometimes firebombed by black militants. Yet in every instance in which non-coital related contraceptive methods, that is, in short, the pill or the loop, have been made available to working class and lower class black women, and follow-up studies done on them, the women have been highly cooperative and the results satisfactory. In other words, the black male may be against birth control, but the black female seems to be welcoming it. One may ask whether the recent bad odor of contraception among young black male militants grows out of a fear of genocide or an effort to dominate their women. What about the present mood of black consciousness? Will it prove productive of genuine self-esteem within black families? To what extent is its occasionally highly defensive nature an unwitting revelation of self-despise? Is the present trend toward separatism among black university students and young community militants a genuine effort to become part of a more healthy, pluralistic society in America, one laudable rationalization or reason given for it? Or is it a harbinger of voluntary apartheid? Just as there is a growing gap between America's affluent majority and her poor, there has been a recent trend toward heightened income, education, and other indices of social upward mobility, among the majority of America's Negroes with relation to whites, though the process is painfully slow. At the same time, interdecennial studies in such cities as Cleveland, Los Angeles, show that the black underclass is getting poorer, not only compared to whites, also compared to other Negroes, and even in an absolute sense. The Huff study showed that in what was called the problem neighborhoods of the ghettos, the real income had risen very fast, relatively fast, among Cleveland's Negro population, and faster than it had risen among Cleveland's white population, the real income within these tough neighborhoods had actually declined. The proportion of female-headed families had actually increased. The number of illegitimate, not only the rates of illegitimacy, but the number of illegitimate children had actually increased. Now, so far, there is not much evidence that the poverty program, programs of community action, or even black power campaigns have touched these groups. Can we intervene to bring them into the body politic? If so, how do we do it? Particularly, is this a problem when we consider that automation and cybernation are cutting off the lower rungs of the economic ladder by which the immigrant poor of another era became part of our economic order. It must also be remembered that the white underclass, though proportionately smaller, is twice as numerous as the black underclass, and we mustn't forget them. Meanwhile, central cities become blacker in population and bleaker in outlook. White neighborhoods are frightened and increasingly lacking an understanding of black aspirations, particularly as the tone changes from one of supplication to one of defiance. Young blacks want a piece of the action, but they now seem to want it on their own terms, though their terms are not always crystal clear to gray-bearded Negroes. White youth are meanwhile questioning whether all of our institutions are so rotten that their destruction is bound to be succeeded by something better. Are the youth wiser as well as more virtuous? We know they're more virtuous than the rest of us. I only raise these questions. I wouldn't dare try to answer them. Thank you.
I'm sure we'd all like to thank Dr. Lawrence. I think he added a little bit of soul to that lullaby of Broadway and kept us pretty much awake. So now we thank you all for coming too, and be sure and catch the 7 o'clock meeting tonight at Wells Hall.